Join the powerhouse for legal education. Earn your JD, LLM, master's degree, or certificate from a top 100 law school. Residential and online programs available. Now accepting applications at law.unh.edu. In this special edition of the podcast, we're playing the hour-long latest Civil Liberties in the Presidency, recorded on January 30th, 2020, featuring Democratic presidential candidate and former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. This event was presented by the Warren B. Rudman Center for Justice Leadership and Public Service and the American Civil Liberties Union of New Hampshire.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome. Thank you all for the warm welcome and for coming out this morning. You see, this is what it is like. Ask me what day it is. I'm delighted to, it is Thursday. I'm delighted to be with you all. Thank you for coming out this evening. Thank you to the New Hampshire ACLU. Well, I don't know why you keep hiding behind the, come on, Jeannie. Is she there? Come on out, yeah. And she's waiting for her walk-on music, but I want to just thank the New Hampshire ACLU and the ACLU generally. We've always needed you, but man, do we need you now. And thank you for your service. Appreciate that. I'm hoping that we can spend most of our time in conversation this evening. I thought I'd say a little bit more about my background so you know how I come to these issues, and that I'm not new to these issues, but I also recognize that the issues are always changing. Justice is is elusive. It's a journey. And it's something I understand professionally and also personally. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, much of that time on welfare. And I lived there with my mother, my sister, my grandparents, and various other relatives who came and went in our grandparents' two-bedroom tenement. I've told this story about sharing one of those bedrooms and a set of bunk beds with my mother and my sister. So you go from the top bunk to the bottom bunk to the floor, every third night on the floor. I went to big and broken and overcrowded and under-resourced, sometimes violent, public schools. I can't remember a time I didn't love to read, but I didn't own a book of my very own until I was 14 years old and got a scholarship through a program called A Better Chance to go to Milton Academy, which for me was like landing on a different planet. There are a lot of things we didn't have on the South Side. One thing we had was a very strong sense of community because that was a time when every child was under the jurisdiction of every single adult on the block. You know, you messed up down the street in front of Ms. Jones, she'd go upside your head as if you were hers, and then call home, so you got it two times. And I take from that experience that they were trying to teach us what membership in a community was, which is understanding that we have a stake, each of us, in our neighbors' dreams and struggles, as well as our own. I've had blessing upon blessing. First in my family to go to college, to law school. I practiced first in law school, at the Legal Aid Bureau. It's really where I first got my sense of what being a lawyer was supposed to be about. I was president of the Legal Aid Bureau. I tried my first case there. I joined the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York. I was the last staff attorney hired by Jack Greenberg before he retired. And I did voting rights and death penalty defense work there. A number of those cases alongside the ACLU, actually. It's actually there that I met Governor Clinton when I sued him in a voting rights case, and we worked out the terms of the settlement together, the bones of which really became the motor voter law when he was elected president. And in between the time that I went to join his administration as head of the Civil Rights Division, the time I'd left LDF, I was in private practice doing about 30% of my time in pro bono civil rights, mostly around banking and lending discrimination, some housing discrimination. At the Justice Department, we were responsible for all enforcement of the civil rights laws having to do with race and gender, having to do with schools and voting, also having to do disability issues. And we had a fabulous team and a really, really challenging and exciting time because, you know, to work in an administration in that assignment that actually is interested in the topic was extraordinary. And I was coming behind 8 years of Ronald Reagan and four of George the First, where President Bush, excuse me, where the division had been feeling very dispirited. And so building back up and getting back to work and regaining the engagement of others in the Justice Department and in the Congress was a big part of that work. Meanwhile, we had a rash of attacks on black churches and synagogues in the South. And I was put in charge of that investigation, a multi-agency investigation. At that time, the largest criminal investigation in American history before 9/11. All of which is to say, I can get into my work in the corporate side, where I've been very involved in trying to make the workplace hiring and promotion practices fair. That these issues. I mean, you know, the former head of the, you know, Anthony Romero, former head of ACLU, nationally worked for me in the Justice Department. My niece and nephew work for Massachusetts ACLU. I feel at home. But I do not feel like I have mastered all of the issues. I know some that were on the briefing I got, like around privacy and technology, where I'm still learning, and I hope we can engage on those as well. But I'm getting my cue. I'm going to sit down. I'm glad that we are talking about these issues, as I say, at a time like this, because I don't think the questions of human dignity have ever been fully resolved in our laws or our behaviors in this country, but we've made remarkable progress, much of it in my lifetime. And one of the hardest things, I think, is understanding at once how much progress we have made and how much we have to do, because both of those are true. So let's do that work together.
Thank you, Governor. So we're going to turn to Q&A. I'm going to take the privilege of starting us.
Yes.
So you talked about the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Unit, which is an incredibly important unit to the history of civil rights, and it looks very different in each administration. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, if you were president, what would be your vision for that unit in the Department of Justice?
That it be resourced adequately. It never is. We did better than most. And it often takes an emergency. You know, we got a big boost in our resources at the time of the church arsons, mm-hmm. and attacks on synagogues. But it shouldn't take an emergency. There's civil rights is central to the national character, or ought to be. I think the question of the gap mm-hmm. between our reality and our ideals is the work of citizenship, not just the work of the Civil Rights Division. And so we had all those challenges, and others have, and I think that has to be remedied. Mm-hmm. And when I say resources, I don't just mean money, although that's a part of it. The Voting Rights Act has been eviscerated. And it's so interesting, the basis of the decision in plain terms was everything's changed, we don't need that anymore. And then right after the decision, we went back to doing what we used to do. Mm-hmm. So vote suppression, the mm-hmm. purging initiative, it's very intentional. The gerrymandering of districts so that we get less and less in the way of democratic outcomes yeah. from our democracy. So this is all a part of what we call our democracy yeah. agenda. And legislation that I think we have to move, money is another big yeah. part, money in politics.
So could we see a comprehensive 21st century Voting Rights Act passed under a Deval Patrick administration?
Yes, it is certainly on our agenda, this democracy okay. agenda that I've referred to. It's up on the website if people want to check it out. Mm-hmm. I say yes with that, moment's hesitation, because we need a Congress that is yeah. going to work with us as well, and I have some ideas about that.
We will start with questions from the audience, and I was pestered ahead of time by a particular audience member,
yeah.
so we're going to jump right to them.
I didn't like your understanding and stand on prisoners' voting rights
yeah.
in prison and outside.
Yeah,
I find it very perplexing, and some days I wake up and say, well, this is what I think, and the next day is different. So.
You mean you're sorting out your own thinking on this?
Right.
Yeah. So. Where are you?
Hmm?
Where are you today? on your thinking on the subject?
I think across the board,
yeah,
they should be able to.
Yeah. Who else, say your first name.
Steph.
Steph?
Yes.
Who agrees with Steph? Yeah? Yep. The question is, voting rights for the incarcerated, should you, I think Steph is saying where he is right now is that you should never forfeit your voting rights. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Right? Even during incarceration. And there's a sort of a spectrum of opinion, I think, on where we should be. You want to vote?
I would say after somebody is
released. Is out?
Yeah.
How many, what, say your first name.
Kitty.
How many agree with Kitty? Kitty says after you're out. Yeah? Who says is obvious? Yeah, no question? It is a question in a lot of places. It ought not be a question. I worked hard on the Florida initiative, and it had broad... Did you follow this, by the way? You folks follow this? It had broad bipartisan support. It was really exciting. And then we got the wrong governor, in my view, and they're right back to their old tricks. So I am there, meaning I am where Kitty is. I had a conversation the other day, Steph, where someone said, well, why not at least during parole as a part of, you know, reentry? And that made a lot of sense to me. I hadn't thought very deeply about it. But the question of what, I mean, it's a big, broader question around which I have a lot of views on how we have treated our criminal justice system as if it was just about warehousing and not about preparing people, 90%+ of whom come out, not about preparing people to be out and be successful once they are out. But I think that the idea that is embedded in our law is that when you commit particularly a felony, that you forfeit your liberty. Liberty includes the vote. So I wouldn't fall on my sword on it, but the idea that while you're in, you forfeited your right, when you come out, automatically you get it back. And I'm open to the question about whether, as a part of reentry, you should, during your parole period. But talk me out of that.
So I'm going to try and talk you out of it.
Okay.
Because the ACLU has actually been asking candidates to commit to voting while incarcerated.
Yep.
Maine and Vermont, you don't lose your right to vote. You can vote while incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Here in New Hampshire, you can vote if you are incarcerated pre-trial, if you're waiting for a trial.
Well, that seems right.
Or if you're or if you're jailed for a misdemeanor.
I see. Okay.
So we already have the technicalities for voting, right? You vote via absentee ballot.
Right.
So here's the question. Do you acknowledge that race plays a pretty big factor in mass incarceration and who
pretty
gets
big?
Funneled into? So let's do it. Do you think the criminal justice system is racist?
Of course.
Which means that the people impacted by felon disenfranchisement are disproportionately people of color.
That is true.
So when we talk about voter,
I see you leading me down the path.
Yes.
Here.
Yeah. Well, this I think is a lot of why the ACLU feels so strongly about this. Is we have so many politicians who will openly say the criminal justice system is racist and we have got to fix that. And they support voting rights and really oppose voter suppression, but then don't put the two together.
Well, I hear that. Look, in representing people on death row, for example, mm-hmm. I would say I won more commutations than I did acquittals.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The system is broken. But it doesn't mean that everybody who's caught up in it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some people do bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion that you forfeit your liberty, not permanently in every case, yeah. but you forfeit your liberty for a portion, for a period of, mm-hmm. of time. Now that all presupposes that we have purged as much of the injustice out of our justice system as possible. And I think that's where you're going.
Yeah.
So until we reach that promised land, I think you're probably saying the ACLU would say, well, everybody should have
Well, I think we would also say, yes, you lose your liberty, but you do not lose your citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
A condition of voting
that's
is
well
that
said.
You are over 18 and that you are a U.S. citizen.
That's well said. It's interesting because, I have very, very strong feelings about purging.
Yeah.
purging for inactivity. And it's in a way, it's a similar kind of point. Mm-hmm. Okay, I told you to talk me into it. You might have.
Other questions? We have a law professor, so get ready.
Oh, man. I'm amazed you didn't just cold call me.
Well, funny that you mentioned that. ACLU has been doing a lot of work on criminal justice reform in New Hampshire, bail reform, debtors prison reform, ideally fair chance hiring, a lot of initiatives. And a lot of presidential candidates have talked about ending mass incarceration and criminal justice reform. The First Step Act made a what I consider a minor step forward. But 90% of all people who are serving jail sentences or prison sentences are serving them at the state level. And it, as a formal matter, as a president, you can't do much about criminal justice reform at the state level. So how do you, I understand you care deeply about criminal justice reform, but as president, how do you get states to do some of the, stop doing some of the crazy stuff they're doing
that
put lots of people in jail?
You know, Professor, yes? Yes. Professor, when I was governor, I was struck by how the leadership on mandatory minimum reform was coming mainly from Republican governors, not out of a sense of justice in most cases, but because the cost was crowding out other issues in the budget. You know, that could bother me, but they got there. And what does bother me is that as a group, they got there before Democratic governors did. When we first proposed ending mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenses in Massachusetts, and I say this respectful of our legislature, which is mainly Democratic, I got a tremendous amount of pushback on the order of, well, we're going to seem like we're soft on crime, right? Because we as Democrats are the first ones to believe the Republican talking points every time. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And if we don't also end, I mean, we can model, look, three strikes and you're out. That was a Democratic president. Right? More governing by slogan. We do it too. And it kind of gave permission for a lot of what happened at the state level. Some of it preceded that, but it gave permission. And the amount of what would, I mean, listen, talk to a federal judge, the amount of what they describe as street crime that's been litigated and prosecuted in federal courts because we've had a war on this or a war on that. You know, there are things we can do to model what we're talking about. And reentry has to be a part of it as well. We did two or three major or comprehensive reform bills in Massachusetts, and bits and pieces of them were passed for the reasons I said. And I just wrap with this comment. One of the reasons why I try to make a point of being out as a candidate and as an elected official is because if you're out with people and you're listening to people, you learn stuff you may not have thought of. And what I kept hearing over and over again is, great, fix the sentencing, but you got to make it possible so we can actually get a job and get going when we get back out. Mm-hmm. We need reentry programs. We moved to ban the box. You know what I'm talking about?
We'll work on that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. When we end, I'll tell you a story that really is one of those things that convinces me policy matters less in the abstract, more where it actually touches people.
The New Hampshire Senate actually passed a fair chance hiring bill today by voice vote, which is amazing. It applies only to state employment, but that's an important first step. Okay. But we've actually heard talk at the federal level of a federal version of Ban the Box, again, focused on federal employment.
Okay.
Would you think of expanding Ban the Box to the private sector through federal legislation?
Look, the answer to that is easy for me, and that is yes. Okay. I've said over and over again, and I apologize if some of you have heard it before, if the character of the candidate is always an issue, cycle to cycle, this time it's the character of the country, mm-hmm. right now. That is, I say that out of anguish about where we are. I also say that out of opportunity. I think we have a real opportunity. And this whole idea that part of what makes us powerful and special is that you get to do yourself over. You get to reinvent yourself in this country. You get to reimagine yourself. We would never treat a child, most of us, of our own. I'm not trying to infantilize the incarcerated. That's not what I'm saying. But we'd never treat a member of our family or community as if, you know, they were dead to us if they crossed the line. You try to figure out how to restore them. And if we want a safer community and we want a community organized around our values, then I think we have got to be thinking about ways, practical ways. This is back to how policy actually touches people, to enable people to succeed when they've come out. Presuming, as I said, we've gotten the sentences right. Yeah. We've returned more authority to judges. Mm-hmm. That's another shift in the same period of time. And I'm going to stop talking, but I want to tell you before we leave. This is what I have to remember: the ban the box. And I have to remember to come back to this amazing, tell you about this amazing reentry program we visited in South Carolina a couple weeks ago.
That sounds great. I'm going to shift us over to privacy, which is a big issue in New Hampshire. We're one of the few states that really leads on privacy. Mm-hmm. So we have a bill that's going through the legislature right now to ban facial surveillance technology, which is very inaccurate and very prone to abuse. And one of the concerns that has started increasing is concern about government surveillance because of the power of tech, right? Amazon has all of these little videos on doorbells now, and your phone is watching or listening, and you have Amazon echoes in your paranoid.
Yeah.
But from a federal government standpoint, where do you see federal privacy protections going in this giant era of big tech?
Did you see there was a report? I lose track of days, but in the Times not long ago about China and what they're able to do with existing technology.
Which is why people are wearing masks when they go out on the streets, because they're afraid of being identified and tracked.
Is that why?
Yeah,
okay.
In Hong Kong.
You mean in Hong Kong? Oh, yeah. Never mind. I'll come back to Beijing another time. But my wife and her older sister are best friends. Mm-hmm. And they both have freckles, and they're both as cute as they can be. And my sister-in-law can open my wife's iPad with facial recognition. Right? It's chilling.
It's terrible.
I was, we have this bus. You got to see this bus we have out here. Oh my gosh. We have this bus. We started a bus tour today. Yeah. And there was a reporter in the back with me doing an interview between stops. And I was in between emails typed on my iPhone. And I put the iPhone down to do the interview. And when I came back, the whole interview had been transcribed into the email I didn't ask the lady, the Siri, to do anything. I just put the thing down, and so it's creepy. And I used to think it was just my generation that was worried about it.
I'm terrified.
One used to be told is that my kids had lived so much of their lives on the internet and out loud that they had a different expectation of privacy. I don't think it's true anymore, and I'm glad it's not true, because I think that the temptation to harvest information is huge, and I think that when the temptation to harvest information is great, the impact usually falls on people like me. Yep. And I'm not saying it's not serious for everybody, but I think that's why my antenna are up. I don't know what the solutions are, except to say this: you know, the UK has a regime that is continent-wide. Mm-hmm. I think California has stepped out. You guys are about to step out. It's very hard to see how you do this state by state.
This is federal.
Yeah, right.
Especially for the private sector. If you're going to regulate Google and Facebook, it's got to be at the federal
level.
That's
a whole other story. I mean, honestly.
From a privacy standpoint, specifically, the exchange or sale of data.
Between them and others, So I was going to say, maybe not just national. It might be more about a global coalition, and there are going to be some who lay outside that coalition, but we ought to know.
Yeah. Other questions?
Thank you, Governor. So this is sort of related to privacy, but I was curious about your thoughts on the rights of whistleblowers. It's something that's...
Why are you asking?
There's a prominent whistleblower in the... obviously, it's in the news now, and the Trump administration has repeatedly threatened whistleblowers, particularly the Ukraine whistleblower. But even President Obama, who I love and admire, even his record on whistleblowers was not great. So I'm curious, as president, how would you balance safeguarding the rights of whistleblowers while also maintaining national security interests?
Yeah. In the case of President Obama, I think you're talking about the breach of national security information.
Yes.
Yeah, look, as an executive, first of all, I know what the law is, and I know the importance of protecting the privacy or anonymity of the whistleblower, because in the absence of that, we don't get the information on breaches or violations that we need, and we must have that information. As an executive, I know what it's like to be in a situation where there's incoming and you don't know how to give it any context. We had an experience like that when I was at Coca-Cola, actually. And in that case, the whistleblower was not anonymous, but he was, he was a mid-level, lower-level person. It was very brave of him to come forward, and it was very typical of large institutions to want to go hard at him. And I kept saying, look, forget about him for just a second. What about this that we just learned from the whistleblower? What's our, how are we dealing with that? And ultimately, I spent time just one-on-one with the whistleblower, because he needed to trust me enough to get enough information to get to the crux of the problem. And there was no other way to do it. And I didn't go looking for, I asked, and we sort of created all kinds of protections around him. But what I'm saying is, from an executive's point of view, I understand, not in the case of the president, that's just the latest example of bullying. But I understand why you'd want to know. But I think that if you place this all in the balance, better to have protected anonymity in the whistleblower than not, because you learn things about what is and is not working that's important to have.
Other questions?
Kitty has a question. Don't forget her. Thank you.
I think there's one overriding issue as important as all the others are, but we won't have time to deal with them if we don't deal with the climate, and I'm curious to know how you will deal with that.
I went to and I'm glad you brought it up in this context of civil rights and civil liberties. I went to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, a few days after launching the campaign here. And I visited with someone named Senator Hoggs. I think that's how it's pronounced, H-O-G-G-S. And he's been a real leader on climate issues. He's written a lot about it. And I met him there in part because it was his district, but he wanted to show me a place where the river had crested 18 feet above its high water mark and 30 feet behind, I think I'm right about these numbers, two 200-year events within a few years of each other. And he made the point that the question is not whether we're late, the question is whether we're too late. So I take that to heart. I believe in science. Maybe I should say the obvious. I believe in science. By the way, in terms of whether humans are the cause or not, we didn't need to know the cause of polio to deal with it. Right? We dealt with it. We faced it. It was helpful to learn, but I think I'm right that when we first started to try to figure out how to have a polio vaccine, we didn't know what caused it. We know we have a climate crisis. So steps. Some of this I take from our experience in Massachusetts. We joined REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, I think on the second day maybe, of being in office. And we used all the proceeds from the auctions, all of them, to invest in energy efficiency, particularly subsidies for the homes and apartments of working people. It's how we got to be number one in energy efficiency. We closed the remaining coal-fired plants because we were generating more than enough clean alternatives in solar, which went, I think, from 25 to nearly 3,000 megawatts in the first 6 years or so, and some from wind and a lot from energy efficiency, which is the first kilowatt of savings, right? We have a statewide recovery and resiliency plan, and we invested behind it. And it's obviously tailored for different parts of the of the state. And meanwhile, we had an exploding clean tech sector. Jobs there, one of the fastest growing sectors in our recovery, is one of the reasons we came out of recession faster. And I mentioned that last point because I think among the false choices we are sold is that you have to wreck the economy to move to a carbon-free future. It's just not true. It's not true. If I'm right about the timing, I think I am, in the first couple of days, we've got to rejoin the Paris Accords, or else we've missed that window. We also need to raise the standards of the goals of the Paris Accords. I'm not sure we have the credibility to do that on day one. But as a coalition, we must. We've got to step up our game. And I think that there are opportunities. And I'll just say this one last thing about, because I know I'm going on too long, but I want to make one about an opportunity and then something that I don't think we always focus on about the interconnection of policy. We do innovation historically pretty well in America. What we don't do very well is transition. Which is to say, we move to the next thing and we get around to the impact later, if at all. And what's interesting to me, and I think a huge opportunity for us, is to bring people along. You know, let's go to coal country and make the point, look, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stone. It's because we got a better idea. And now we have a better idea. Now, what's your role in this? You know, how about you do wind? You develop and test the wind blades. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that the innovation...
There has to be a lot of training.
There, of course, but that's an opportunity is what I'm saying. That's an opportunity. And the last thing I want to say about this is that, and it's one of the reasons why in our plan I'm favoring an international organization to hold to account the goals that nations make. Is that if you think we have a refugee problem now, you wait, because it's the most vulnerable people who live right in the way of the crisis that's coming.
Are you going to ask about yesterday?
I don't even have a question. Just to say, Wednesday, there's a climate forum at Bank of New Hampshire Stage, and Governor Patrick's going to be there. It's like an all-day thing from 9 to 6 or something.
Where is it?
Bank of New Hampshire Stage, the New Capital Center.
When is that?
Wednesday, the 5th.
I'm just going to say all of what I said again.
Yeah. Maybe. You have 45 minutes.
Yeah, I do. Well, it took me about 45 minutes.
We have another question.
Good. Well, You segued perfectly into the question I was going to ask. I was going to talk to you about my thoughts and my concerns about immigration or immigration policy. And I was thinking about ICE and the border stops and family separation, the southern border issues and child detention. But you hit on something in terms of immigration that is huge, and it ties into the climate, and that is climate refugees. Yeah. I've read a couple of books lately about that. That is a far greater problem than anything that we're seeing on any of our borders.
Which has to be planned for.
Yes.
Anticipated instead of just waiting and hoping it doesn't happen.
Proactive.
Yeah.
So I am concerned about the current travel bans for immigration. I am an immigrant, and I'm looking at the poster back here, and I see the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
When we came to this country in 53, that's the first thing we saw when our ship came into New York Harbor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it meant a lot to everyone on that ship.
Right.
And your thoughts on immigration and tying this all together?
Yeah, I often feel, I've been to naturalization ceremonies. I've spoken at naturalization ceremonies. I often feel like the people being naturalized understand us better than we do. They get us. They understand what makes America great, which is not it's not material wealth or military might. It's this handful of civic ideals.
Proud to be an American.
Right. I think we need a comprehensive fix, not piecemeal. And for me, that means a path to citizenship for the people who are here and undocumented and living in the shadows. I think they should come out. I don't think just like that. I mean, there are conditions, but I think they should come out. I think we do not and should not trade border security for that. That's another one of those false choices. We should have border security. A wall is dumb and expensive. There are technologies that make, I mean, not the scary ones, but there are technologies that could be much more efficiently deployed. And we could do it for real and not just as a racist trope. Because we, you know, nobody said anything about the northern border, which is longer. So, you know, I get the code. But, you know, even on legal immigration, our systems are built for another time. They're not built for right now. It's true on refugees. It's true of becoming a naturalized citizen. The H-2B and the H-1B and H-2B visas are not adequate to the task. You know, there are bunches of places where you can come pretty easily if you look like you. Mm-hmm. And less so if you look like me. Mm-hmm. So are we going to have systems that are consistent with our best values or not? And are they going to be modern to the task? And when I say modern to the task, just make this last point. Capital is global. Labor is not. And that's a part of what our immigration issue has been. People move to where the opportunity is. They want to move to where the opportunity is. And that's not easy. I'm not talking about open borders, but I am talking about how we have a system that is responsive and quick. You get an answer, you get a visa, you come, you leave when you're supposed to, because we make the system work and we kind of fix our attitude of welcome so it's more like what you felt when you first arrived.
So I'm going to follow up that with a really specific question that we've been asking a number of candidates, which is, on day one of your presidency, would you repeal the travel ban?
Yes. Yes.
I love simple questions and simple answers. I also want to follow up.
By the way, based on the number of forums I've been to, I have a whole lot of stuff to do on day one. Why are people going to be asking
we'll
me about day one?
We'll cram 48 hours into that 24. Okay. But I see a number of faces around the room today who were at the State House yesterday sitting through hours and hours and hours of testimony on bills that would severely restrict reproductive rights.
Right.
And these are bills that did not originate in New Hampshire. These are ideas that we have seen across the country, and they just happened to have arrived in New Hampshire.
Alec. You know about Alec?
I do. But I think the question is, we can fight this at a state level, and we obviously will. We're going to defeat these bills. But at some point, we've got to take national action on this. So as president, how would you protect reproductive rights?
You know, it's interesting to me how the right, the radical right, often talk about the importance of small government until it comes to the most intimate decisions in people's lives. And then they're all over. You know, Barney Frank used to say about Republican leadership, they're deeply committed to children until they're born. And then after that, you're on your own. Look, I just think there's some zones of privacy that are just, there's certain things government just doesn't do well. Intimate, difficult, medical, conscience, in many cases, faith-connected decisions that government should just stay out of. By the way, that used to be a conservative rationale for not doing a whole bunch of, or doing a bunch of things, and that's how I arrive at my support for reproductive freedom. And by the way, it's not the same thing as support for abortion. Mm-hmm. But I'm not afraid of saying the word because that seems to be a thing right now. That's not what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this is not my business as president or as a public person. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is a willingness to say that out loud a lot. Part of it is the democracy agenda I talked about earlier, because this is one of a handful of issues. Gun safety is another one. Immigration reform is another one, where we can't get the Congress to produce a democratic outcome because we have contorted it so that it won't. I do think we need legislation around privacy. I fear sometimes that undertaking, because Congress will look for all kinds of ways to mess with a simple idea, but I still think it's worth trying. And of course, ultimately, we have to have a court we can count on. And I think the reason there's been so much state legislative activity mm-hmm. is because folks feel like the other side has a court that might go the distance. And I don't know if what you're asking me is this, whether I'm quite ready to expand the size of the court.
That's up to you.
But yeah, I mean, it's out there. People mm-hmm. are, because I don't know where that stops.
Yeah.
But I short of that, I think I'm prepared to do everything.
So not within the first 24 hours, I'll let you sleep. But within the first year, maybe, would one of the commitments in terms of supporting reproductive rights include repealing the Hyde Amendment?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's in I'm sorry. I keep assuming everybody's seen the policy stuff we put out. Of course. Yeah.
Questions?
Coming to me. I didn't know if you're looking behind
me. Don't forget, there's a gentleman who's been trying since the beginning in the way back.
So. Go to him?
No, it's all right. It's all right. Just
okay. I'll make it quick. And I'll tee it up as saying the balance between states' rights and federal responsibility. In your career, you surely have faced the abuse and what's hidden behind a claim of states' rights.
Yeah.
And at the same time, today we're faced with a situation where we have states have abandoned capital punishment, and we have a federal government trying to execute someone in every state. We have the federal government trying to force marijuana laws enforcement in ways that at the state level, people have said, we don't want it.
Right.
So your thoughts on how we balance the laboratory, which is the individual states,
right,
with the responsibilities of a nation?
You know, I have been on both sides of that one. You know, when I was at DOJ, we got pushback from local officials and states about how federal civil rights laws should or should not, or did or did not impose on what they were about. And then as governor, it's like, wait a second. I start from this place. States' rights was an argument invented in defense of slavery.
Yep.
And we should not forget that.
That's
where it comes from.
Yes, it does.
And so we've talked about the laboratories of democracy and so on. We were a laboratory. It was great. It was terrific to have that latitude. But it feels to me like sooner or later we're going to have to decide whether we're a country and be a country. The question about how you strike the balance was meant to move from age to age. It was meant to. So I'm prepared to engage, but there are a whole bunch of things that just don't work at the state level alone. We did terrific gun safety laws in Massachusetts. But if you can buy a case of guns, you know, in a neighboring state or two and drive them in, how effective is that? You understand what I'm saying? I get a little agitated about this. I mean, so you
get noticed.
Yeah, well, and some of it is just so practical. It's like, you know, this states' rights doesn't come up in this context, but it's hard to plan transportation state by state. How do you do a high-speed rail, you know, to the Hudson River and stuff? Big deal. Took me 15 minutes. Want to go again? Let's go back. You know, if we are serious about meeting our national needs, then we shouldn't be shy about that. Now, how you engage states to collaborate on solutions is really exciting, because I think collaboration gets better better solutions. But so I don't want to be heard as being heavy-handed as president, but I do want to express a little impatience that we spend so much time on critical issues, particularly civil rights and civil liberties issues, on an argument whose roots are pretty smelly to begin with.
And maybe I didn't do a good job of my point. My point was, where you have local issues or local concern, you have local values.
Yep.
And I'll point to New Hampshire. We yep. now do not have capital punishment,
mm-hmm.
but we have a federal government. Exactly. We have a federal government trying to find an excuse to find somebody in New Hampshire that they can murder.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the question of reproductive rights. It crosses many things. Local values should be respected when they're not abused. And that's the trouble I have, is balancing. Because, yes, I remember Jim Crow. I am that old. I can remember the abuses. But at the same time, we're now seeing abuse from the federal government,
that's right.
In my opinion.
That's right. Well, you know, I oppose the death penalty. I've worked against the death penalty. When the bombs went off at the Marathon and we found the surviving perpetrator, he was tried in a federal court in Boston and sentenced to death. Mm-hmm. And I saw that destruction. I met those families. I spent time with them. I knew some of them. But I still don't believe this is in the category of decisions the government doesn't make very well. I remember litigating a case called McCluskey versus Kemp, and it was a big systematic discrimination case in the death penalty out of Georgia, where we demonstrated unequivocally that the chances of being sentenced to death if the defendant was black and the victim was white were exponentially greater than any other combination. And the district court said, you know, essentially, this is undeniable proof. And the Court of Appeals said, this is hard to deny, in effect. And then we went up to the Supreme Court, and they said, well, what do you expect us to do about it? I mean, I can tell you stories that would raise your hair that convinced me that the death penalty... Yeah, more you. All right, that's enough.
Well,
I'm done with him.
One issue that he raised that I want to touch upon, because again, it's actively being pursued this legislative session, is cannabis legalization.
Yeah.
New Hampshire is an island. We are surrounded, including by Canada, by territory where cannabis is legal. And so Granite Staters are currently regularly crossing borders.
You're talking about medical or recreational?
Legal. So we have therapeutic cannabis in New Hampshire, yeah. but we don't have legalized cannabis.
Yeah.
So as president, one of the issues to truly legalize cannabis, we need action at the federal level to remove it.
It's time. I get that. I will tell you, in Massachusetts, it was done by referendum.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a lot of energy for it, to tell you the truth, because we just had so many other things going on. You know, you reflect, though, on what the impact has been in federal sentencing on black and brown people and poor people generally use and possession of marijuana, when it's mm-hmm. become just so. Now, there's more research to do, but, you know, cigarettes don't end you up in prison, and they are harmful. So I think it's time to decriminalize.
Decriminalize or legalize?
Well, what's the right term?
Does it legalize?
Legalize, okay.
Yeah. We already decriminalized here. We just haven't legalized.
Okay.
Hi, Governor.
Hey.
I worked on your 06 campaign.
Hey.
Down in Buzzards Bay and Bourne.
Were you living there then?
Yes, yes, I was.
Are you a refugee? You live up here now?
Yes, I do. Okay. Yes, I do. I was wondering, given the amount of infighting the Democratic primary has seen, and it seems to be increased tensions between so-called progressive and moderate factions, and given how your positions seem to be pretty similar in a lot of ways to a few of the other candidates, like such as Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar. One, how are your positions different from Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, and to a lesser, and Michael Bloomberg? And two, given your polling position, pardon the flippancy, why are you still running?
You know, if polls were to be trusted, we'd have a different president right now, wouldn't we? In fact, you remember that 2006 campaign? If the polls were right, I wouldn't have been governor the first time or the second time. Don't ask me about polls. Have you made up your mind? Then I'm not late for you. And remember that. It's not up to pollsters and pundits to tell us what the outcome's supposed to be. We decide. We decide. I haven't studied the other candidates' positions. I know the people you mentioned and others in the race, and I think they bring a lot. They make me proud to be a Democrat. We all have great ideas. The difference between me and the others is they have ideas, I have results. Getting health care to 98.5% of our residents, that wasn't about a pronouncement. That was about bringing in a whole bunch of different points of view and learning as we went, which is why I believe the next step ought to be a public option, because there's value in that competitive tension. I've seen that. Doesn't mean that you compromise the ambition or the ambition of the goal. It means you bring some humility alongside it to acknowledge what we all know to be true, which is that nobody, no candidate, no party has a corner on all the best ideas. And if we want change that lasts, not change that is a talking point for our party, but change that lasts, you got to bring people in and share the victory. That's how we got criminal justice reform. That's how we're number one in energy efficiency. It's how we got to number one in school achievement and closing achievement gaps. The Achievement Gap Act, that was all about bringing in a variety of different views and collaborating on a solution that was going to be have enough flexibility so that teachers could actually meet the needs of their specific kids instead of one solution fits all. So, you know, I do think I have a lot of respect for the other candidates. As I say, many of them are friends of mine, and I don't mean disrespect to your question, or frankly, to all the people who have worked really hard for a long, long period of time. But nobody else in this race has the range of life and leadership experience I do. Nobody, domestically and overseas, public and private. And I was complaining to Barack Obama once, not this time, about the only two things I don't like about campaigning are asking people for money and the bragging. And he said, get over it. So I'm over it.
One question I want to make sure we touch on is LGBTQ rights.
Yeah.
And starting January 1st here in New Hampshire, Granite Staters can now access an X on their driver's license. So you can have an M, an F, or an X for gender non-binary. Yeah, and there's legislation right now to add it to birth records. Mm-hmm. But obviously government ID is supposed to be consistent,
right?
Which means passports.
Yeah.
So would you support federal legislation to make sure that federal ID includes a third gender marker?
That seems right. As a matter of justice, as a matter of pragmatics, I don't understand it all. But as you describe it now, that seems pretty straightforward. And maybe that's not the right term to use, but I'm sorry.
You would support it.
I'm sorry. I would. I would support it. But I haven't thought about it beyond this moment. Mm-hmm. So. And I want to understand it, but you know, these issues have been important to me for a long time. You know, long before I was in public life, long before these issues became issues in our family. Mm-hmm. My grandfather swept the floors of a bank on the South Side of Chicago for 60 years, among his other jobs, and he taught me more about respecting the dignity in every living soul than anybody else I've ever met. Mm-hmm. It was about his approach to people, how he carried himself, how he, it was the example, he set. And I want my, not just my policy positions, but my, myself, as a man to do honor to the example that he set, so.
We have time for one more question. Who's a brave soul that's got the really burning question?
I don't know if it's a burning question, but what's your view on income inequality?
What's my view on income inequality?
Yeah.
I don't like it. Do you mean what would I? How do I think we get out of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've had. You remember? You remember when Ronald Reagan was talking about trickle down economics? This is it. This didn't happen by accident. It didn't happen overnight. We started down this path in 1980, and we've been, you know, tripping our way down that hill for a long time. This is exactly what it looks like. And the notion was you hoard all the benefits among a few, and it'll the rest of it will trickle down to as necessary to everybody else. And it was always an empty idea, and it's still an empty idea. We call it something else today, but this was the outcome. And so I'm of the view that we have to be about more than redistribution. I'm going to come back to redistribution because I think we've been stuck in this zero-sum gain loop for some while. We have to have an economy that grows out to the middle and the marginalized and not just up to the well-connected. And that's what our opportunity agenda is about. It's about investing time, ideas, and money in education, in innovation, and in infrastructure, which is the strategy we used to great effect to come out of a recession in Massachusetts to a 25-year employment high, all kinds of jobs. We didn't get everything right, but as a strategy, it was incredibly powerful. I think the tax system is broken. I don't favor a wealth tax, and the reason I don't is because I don't think wealth is the problem. I think greed is the problem. We want aspiration. When I was growing up on the South Side, nobody said, you know, they're bad because they're wealthy on the North Side. It was, you know, play by the rules, work real hard, and you can have your chance too, which when I think about it, getting that message from black people on the South Side of Chicago was an act of faith in the American dream that still blows my mind. But we don't have fair rules, and hard work isn't always rewarded. And so rather than a wealth tax, I think directionally, I get it. I would raise the, I would not do that. I would raise the estate tax, though, back to the 55% it was the time before last. And I'd use those non-recurring revenues in part to eliminate existing student debt. And there's some other one-time things we need to do. Public higher ed, we treat it like a private university or college with a state grant. And it's expensive because we've been draining the public out of it, just like we have in the K-12 system. And so we need to reinvest in that. And I think on the personal income tax side, all income ought to be income. I don't care. You know, it's wages, it's dividends, it's carried interest, which is the thing in my old line of work. It's income. Just treat it all as income. Let's simplify the system significantly and have three brackets where everybody is contributing and you don't get to hide. Same is true on the corporate side, but with more details on the website.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. See you next Thursday. More than 94% of our law grads get jobs in the open market within 10 months of graduation. That's better than Harvard and Yale. Join the powerhouse, now accepting applications at law.unh.edu.